Happy New Year and welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT, the Society for Underwater Technology. My name's Emily Boddy, and each week we're bringing you interviews with our members, guests and colleagues from the global underwater technology community. Podcast 43, 7th of January 2021. In this episode, our former CEO Steve Hall speaks to David Todd from HR Wallingford. David will be introducing the work of HR Wallingford, including how they build massive scale models of real-world ports, harbours and estuaries to physically model water flow, turbulence and the behaviour of ships and platforms for a variety of global customers. This is the first of three interviews which we had with HR Wallingford, and the others will be released over the coming weeks.
Hello everybody, my guest today is David Todd. He's from HR Wallingford. And he's going to tell us about this remarkable installation, which some of you may have had the pleasure to visit, which actually still has physical models of ports, estuaries, harbours, and is playing a substantial and quite leading role in the world in this kind of physical modelling. So, David, can you tell me a little bit about who you are, where you trained, and about this remarkable facility you have at Wallingford?
Great to be here, Steve. Thank you for having me. I work as the lab manager and as a principal scientist at HR Wallingford. We're an engineering company in Oxfordshire in the UK that specialises in really in engineering of the built environment. So we work anywhere that water meets people, I suppose. That means that we do quite a lot of large area modelling, CFD, engineering and design work, met ocean studies, sort of flooding, water resources, anything that you can really think of that's to do with the combination of people and water.
Okay.
And the company started quite a long time ago as a government department. So it was the Hydraulics Research Station in the 1940s.
Hence the HR.
Hence the HR. Right. Yeah, okay. Which stands for Hydraulics Research. Yeah. And we were set up to look at the interaction of water and sediment initially. And we've been building and testing these sort of scale physical models right from the beginning. So the company was privatized in the 80s. And I suppose we've been sort of making and breaking things for more than about 70 years now.
Excellent. What was your own background, Dave, to end up coming into this field?
So I did an oceanography degree at Bangor University in North Wales. And that was really quite a formative part for me. I'd originally intended to do marine biology, but somehow ended up doing oceanography instead. But got to work with some great people like sort of Jaco Bass and Dave Bowers. Finished in 2008, right as the recession started to hit.
Many people are now familiar with.
Yeah. And I was offered a PhD position in sediment dynamics, which gave me the opportunity, I suppose, to become more educated while being paid and waiting out the recession as well. So I worked on flocculation of sediments in the Dee estuary, sort of looking at how the material moves through the estuary over the course of a year. And immediately after that, started work at HR Wallingford, initially as a numerical modeller, running hydrodynamic and sediment transport models and sort of designing dredge channels, looking at rates of infill imports or looking at beach erosion from transect data, that kind of thing, but all very much sediment transport based.
Okay. And when did you get your doctorate?
That was in 2014.
Okay.
So finished my PhD in 2014.
Excellent. So 6 years on, did you go straight to HR Wallingford or did you do other things first?
No, I was straight in. About 2 weeks after I'd handed in my PhD thesis, I had my first day with the company. So not as much of a break as I think I would have liked after completing the PhD, but a great place to move straight onto.
Brilliant. So describe what would a visitor, a first-time visitor to HR Wallingford would see?
So when you come into the physical modelling lab, I suppose it's quite like stepping into an aircraft hangar. You've got this absolutely huge building. It's about 14,000 square metres, so it's really quite vast. And I guess what really strikes me is that it's busy all of the time. You've got these large basin areas, so large sort of testing facilities that are basically sort of large rectangle shapes filled with water, with sediments, waves being produced, current systems running. There's plant driving around, so diggers, forklift trucks, dump trucks. You've got waves crashing all around you, scientists and engineers all over the place with sort of state-of-the-art equipment, poring over drawings. It's just a place that really feels busy. You know, there's a real sort of buzz to the place as all of these different experiments are going on in the various different parts of the building.
Mm. Yes, it's an extraordinary sight. There's something of the Raiders of the Lost Ark hangar about it, isn't there, when you go in there, is because it is quite a, it's a vast space. And as you say, there are, it's not just one model, is it? I mean, typically, how many different projects have you got going on at the same time?
Usually 5, 6, 8, but we have an awful lot of facilities. We've got sort of 8 basin areas, so 8 areas where we would run waves or waves and currents, and 5 flumes, which are sort of much narrower facilities for doing sort of sections through breakwaters or smaller scale studies.
And are you tending to operate at a fairly consistent scale?
Reasonably, yeah. So the largest facilities that we run will go up to a scale of probably 1 to 10 to 1 to 20, and then down to about 1 to 100 for the sort of large areas of coastline that we simulate.
Mm, okay. And are there particular advantages to doing this kind of physical modelling as opposed to the traditional, well, I suppose this was the traditional form of modelling, but today, I guess the vast majority of modelling is done digitally. So where would you say the strengths are of still using a physical model of a port harbour or estuary?
I suppose for as long as I've been doing this, and for as long as anyone that I have spoken to has been doing this, people have really been saying that physical modelling is going to become obsolete as computers get more and more powerful. But it really continues to fit in this strange space between two different kinds of computer modelling. So when you're looking at large regions, sort of tens to thousands of kilometres in size, we use large area models, so like the Telemax suite, that are fairly low resolution and quite simplified in terms of the equations that they use, but really good for those very, very large areas. And then for smaller regions, like if you're looking at a power station outflow or something like that, we would use a CFD model. So they're very high resolution, so they cover very small areas very well from centimetres to metres. But that means they're very computationally expensive. So they take a long time to run. You know, they take a long time, and they would take a very long time to do an area sort of the size of a port or a long strip of beach or something. And so physical modelling really fits in that gap in between those two kinds. So when it would take too long to run a CFD model, but you need something more complex than a large area model, people turn to physical modelling. And with that, really, you get real-time feedback. You know, if a structure fails or falls over, then you know immediately because you're observing it. So you don't have to wait for a model run to finish. There are less simplifying assumptions. So there are scale effects within the models, but you don't need to select a turbulence closure scheme or a bed roughness formula or something of that kind, because what you're watching is nature taking its course.
Mm.
So the uncertainties that you have within the model are reduced as you're not relying on empirical formulae with what you're doing. So yeah, we're still here, I suppose, 70 years later.
And doing really well. So how would the process start? You know, I guess a client somewhere, you know, perhaps they want to build a breakwater extension, or they may be thinking about a tidal energy scheme or whatever it is they're thinking of. Do they come to you with a proposal saying, you know, can you build this for us? Or, you know, how does the system work?
It's quite varied. We get involved in projects at all stages, I suppose. So right from when a detailed design has been completed and a client needs a few tests to verify that the design works, all the way back to a representative of a government somewhere in the world phoning up and telling us that they need a new port. And often in the initial conversation, that will be all we get told. You know, it may be a country next door has just announced that they're building a new port and we want one that's bigger and better than theirs, in which case you have to go through everything, the economic analysis of which area would be most benefited, social analysis on what the social structures are. And so, you know, all the way through the bathymetric surveys and right from the very, very beginnings of the early planning stages, the master planning, all the way through the feed, all the way through to the detailed design. So we can get involved in all of it. But it's incredibly varied what stages we come into projects at.
Mm. So do you get presented with the, you know, the proverbial blueprints, or are you having to send a team out to do a on-site survey to start off with?
Both, yeah. The majority of the time we come in at a later stage. So we'd come in after the master planning stage has been done or through all the detailed work. And the physical modelling really fits in two separate areas, I suppose. One, at the beginning when you're looking at the planning for what you're going to do. So to make sure that the concepts that you've come up with will actually work. And again, later on as a design verification tool, before you actually start to construct anything, you just want to make sure that it's going to stand up.
And are you having to take into account some things are hard to scale, I guess, samples of, you know, the sand or the concrete blocks that are going to be used as the coastal protections? How do you take into account those sort of scale effects of the materials you're using or the choices of structure?
Yes, good question. So there's a lot of considerations in the planning of the experiments that we do. And one of the important things is that we're always trying to maximize the scale that we can offer, because the bigger the scale that you work at, the more accurate the model results are going to be, right? So if you look at things like a breakwater study, you scale the armor or the armor units on the top of the breakwater for stability so that it takes the same amount of energy to move them as it would do at full scale. But within that breakwater, you have a layer of core material, and that core material needs to be scaled for permeability.
Okay.
So making sure that the same level of percolation goes on so that you get the same amount of reflection on the internal of the breakwater. Because if the permeability isn't right, either the armor will become unstable too soon as the reflections that you're getting are too high, or it will be too stable if the reflections are too low. Obviously, either one is bad, because if it's unstable too soon, then you use bigger armor, which costs more. So your project becomes much more expensive. And if it's too stable, it's not realistic and could be damaged by a lower return period storm than the design condition that you've got. So scaling correctly is really kind of the main important factor in the modeling that we're doing. But also, say you're looking at a partly constructed breakwater, sort of a test of a one-in-one return period storm that you might get partway through construction. At that point, you may have some of the fill material exposed because you haven't put the armor units on top yet, right? And so there, you don't want to scale it for permeability because it's now exposed, it's on the surface.
You're accidentally washing out all the core.
Yeah, and so you then need to scale it for stability. So you actually can end up running the same experiments multiple times with different parts scaled differently depending on what aspect of the test it is that you're focusing on. Yeah, I suppose that's what makes physical modeling really quite difficult, because it's not possible to reproduce all of the physics all of the time.
If I was seeing you simulating something like a storm surge or extreme weather conditions, would I just see, you know, your artificially created waves, or would there be wind forces acting as well?
We can do wind. Wind is incredibly difficult to simulate because it's very difficult to get the correct boundary layers built up in the sort of space that people have.
Yeah.
So we're lucky that we have the largest area in Europe. You know, we have the largest physical modeling facilities in Europe, so we have more space than anyone else. But I'd say wind is probably the biggest challenge for us, and getting the right layering of the wind as it passes over the surface. But we do waves, we do currents, we do sediments, and we do structures. So they're the main four things that we work with at scale.
Okay. And how quickly does it take to build one of these models?
They're reasonably quick. So we start with sort of a flat, empty basin area. So something that's maybe 30 by 30 meters in size, pretty big space. You take the bathymetric survey that's been done. So you take all the side scan sonar data, you know, the various other data that's been collected, and we chop it up, essentially. So we take long sections through that bathymetry and we reproduce those bathymetric contours with wooden templates. So wood, because it's easy to cut. So we can have good resolution along the length. I suppose for low complexity areas, like the offshore end of the model, then the templates usually spaced sort of 3 meters apart. We go right down to sort of a sub-meter resolution in the areas of interest. And once the templates are put in, we fill the space with ballast and put a 50-millimeter concrete skim on the top to hold it all in place. So you've then got an accurate representation of the seabed within your model. And that, for a large 3D model, will probably take 2 to 3 weeks. But most projects actually start off in the smaller flumes that we've got, where you would just take one long section through the bathymetry and build it very rapidly, you know, in the space of 3 or 4 days in one of the smaller flumes.
So yeah, a fair amount of weekend and evening working as well, I guess.
Often, yes. The clients that we work with often have very tight timelines, and we are in the fortunately unfortunate position that we've been incredibly busy recently. So that's fantastic because everybody has plenty of work to do. But at the same time, it means we have jobs stacking up waiting to go into the facilities. So as soon as one is finished, it's a big rush to make sure that that one gets taken out and the next one gets built. So yeah, my team in particular has been doing an awful lot of overtime and evening work recently, just trying to get through the backlog of work that we have.
Okay. And I guess there's quite a few cubic meters of water involved in these models as well. So you must have quite a spectacular filtration and pumping and emptying system built into the facility as well.
Yeah. So our water is actually taken from boreholes. So we have boreholes on site and an extraction license. So we have a 1500 cubic meter storage tank that feeds the facilities. And the water is just very lightly treated when it comes in. So with a low level biocide just to prevent algal growth while it's being used in the facilities.
Green.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And then we discharge straight back out into the river. So we're actually on the banks of the Thames. So we have a discharge license for that. Mm-hmm. And we have strict conditions on what can be in the water and a suspended solids concentration and various other constraints on that. Mm. But yeah, we discharge straight back into the environment. So we're effectively net zero on the water because we take it from the groundwater and we put it back into the river.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I appreciate for commercial and confidence reasons, you can't necessarily tell me high level details of particular projects you're working on, but are you able to give some examples of the kind of things you guys have been working on recently?
Sure. So I suppose that the things that are easiest to talk about really are the research projects that we do. So the sort of stuff that's funded by UKRI, so by NERC or EPSRC. And we do quite a lot of these working with universities or on joint industry projects. And I suppose that's some of my favourite stuff to work on because we get to do some really amazing, really cutting edge scientific research there. One of the most memorable from the work that I've done recently was working on tsunamis with Tiziana Rossetto and Dave McGovern at UCL.
Okay.
So we actually built the world's most accurate tsunami generator as part of that work, which was pretty incredible. It's a pneumatic system, so it draws water up into a huge storage tank. So it's actually able to simulate the drawdown of water that you see.
Okay,
in
so you'd see the water being sort of sucked back from the coastline before it comes back in again.
Exactly, yeah. And then you let it back out in a controlled manner. So you can create a proper tsunami wave of the right scaled height and the right scaled period. And it was amazing to be involved in a world-first project like that. So we were looking at impact forces on buildings and we were looking at scour around buildings. We did a long series of physical models. It was fantastic to be involved with such a world-leading team of experts and to be able to put brand new technology together that really moved science forward in quite a leap. So before this, the way that we'd simulated tsunami waves was by using very large solitary waves generated by wave makers. Mm. So you would get the wave height right, but the period would be massively shortened. So your forces and just the general way of doing it wasn't particularly accurate. So to be able to create something that massively moved that area of science forwards and to be involved with that was great.
Was it based on a particular geographical area or was it kind of a generic coastal model?
Because of the control that we have over the generator, it works within an air valve. So you've got a constant vacuum going on and there's a valve on the top and you use that to draw the water up. So you close the valve and the water draws up. You open the valve and the water comes back out. So by controlling that valve, we were actually able to simulate the various different tsunami traces from different parts of the world. So the Makata trace, traces from the Indian Ocean tsunami as well. So we were able to recreate those particular waves within the lab environment.
And presumably then you're, as well as HR Wallingford employees, you're going to have quite a number of industry representatives or university students, researchers in the facility at any one time.
Yeah. So we have a lot of clients that like to come and visit us for obvious reasons, because it's quite an exciting, quite a nice place to go and to be able to spend time. But yeah, we also have researchers coming in. We did a lot of work on the EU Hydrolab Plus project recently. So we had probably in excess of 30 researchers across a couple of projects from all over Europe, both academics and private industry people coming in and working with us on those projects, which is just great. And I suppose one of the other more recent pieces of research work that we've done that's probably very relevant to the listenership for the SUT podcast was we did a load of testing on unexploded ordnance.
Oh, yes. It's becoming quite a hot... is that the right word to use? Becoming quite a hot topic of late.
Yeah. So we were looking at self-burial of mines and bombs and how they move around on the seafloor. that was really because there can be quite a long time period between the UXO surveys that get done and the installation of the pipelines or cables or foundations that are going to be going in. So we did a load of tests to help determine how fast the UXO that's left in the seabed moves around. And so what area you might need to avoid, depending on how long the time period has been that's passed between the survey and the installation that you're looking at.
Okay. No, that's really interesting. So anything particularly innovative or cutting edge that's coming up at the moment that you're able to tell us about?
One of the things that really sets us apart, I suppose, from the sort of new innovations and the new technological aspects is that the company makes a lot of the equipment that we use, as well as all the computer modeling, as well as the physical modeling, as well as the engineering and design work that we do. We produce a lot of the equipment that we use within the labs. So we build and export wave makers all over the world and various instrumentation systems as well. So we've just launched a brand new wave probe system that I will be taking delivery of very soon and probably will have by the time the podcast goes out. But yeah, there's a brand new wave probe measurement system that's being launched very shortly that'll be going out. In terms of projects, we've got some really exciting stuff coming up, but I can't really tell you very much about it, I'm afraid. So some absolutely massive port developments that are going on around the world that we'll be doing a lot of the design work and the testing work on, but there's not a huge amount of work that I can tell you about. Sure. I suppose one thing is we're in the middle of revamping our erosion testing rig. So we have an erosion testing rig where we take offshore core samples. So ones that are taken from areas that new renewable foundations are going to be put in or oil and gas platforms and things like that. And we take the core samples and it is destructive testing, but we test them in the erosion rig. So we see what the threshold of motion is for the sediments there and how that varies as you move down the core samples. So rather than people just making a bit of a guesstimate of what the size of sediment is that they have in the area and therefore basing all of their calculations of scour and sediment transport from maybe a few surface grab samples or maybe just a bit of a guess based on what's known historically in the area, we can actually take full core samples and run them through the rig and work out exactly what your threshold of motion is and your threshold of erosion, which then means that when all the modeling and all the calculations are done, it just becomes far, far more accurate because it's very site specific. So you know exactly what you're dealing with in that area in terms of sediment types and in terms of thresholds.
I suppose one question I should ask is, how unique is the HR Wallingford facility? It's certainly the largest of its kind in Europe, isn't it? I mean, is there anything else anywhere that would begin to compare?
I mean, there are a few labs around Europe that have large facilities over in the Netherlands or over in Denmark, but really there's nothing that compares with the size and the versatility of the facilities that we have at Wallingford. Just the sheer number of facilities, but also one of the really big things that sets us apart is our ability to combine different facilities together. So we've spoken a bit about the basins, so the roughly 30 by 30 meter basins, but we have the ability to combine three of our larger basins together so that we have a full 75 meter run, which is really quite unique. And we're finding over time that clients are asking for larger and larger areas to be simulated so that they can do larger areas of coastline or areas including ports, but with areas around the ports as well, so that they can look at far field effects of the developments that they're doing. And that's something that Wallingford is really quite unique in being able to offer this very large area at the same relative scale to be able to see these far field effects.
And given that there is now so much interest in moving into low carbon energy production, is quite a large part of HR Wallingford's work around offshore renewables as well?
Yes. So we actually built a brand new facility in 2014, which is the fast flow facility that was designed specifically around the renewables industry. So that's a very large flume. There's waves, currents, sediments, structures. But the facility was designed to have a deeper water depth than most of the other facilities that we have, because as offshore wind progresses into deeper and deeper water, you need deeper and deeper water depths in your facilities to be able to offer the same scale. So the same scale of testing. So we built the fast flow facility to have a maximum water depth of about 2.5 meters to be able to generate large waves and run fast currents. and take huge amounts of sediment. So you'll find quite a lot of facilities that are able to do waves and sediments, and quite a lot of facilities that are able to do waves and currents. But being able to do waves and currents and sediments is reasonably unique because of the difficult nature of sediments that if you're putting hard quartz through impellers for a very long period of time during experiments, then you can really wear them down quite quickly. So there's quite a lot of smart design that went into the facility. But we also have a large sediment pit in the middle of the facility. So that's sunk an additional meter below the bed, 4 by 4 meters in size, that we can put about 24, 25 tons of sand in there. Ooh. So when we're doing scour and sediment transport experiments, you don't lose any of the depth above the bottom of the facility. You actually just go down below it. So we've done an awful lot of tests of offshore jackets. We've done substations, monopiles, lots and lots of different forms of scour protection, including frond mats, rock protection, even tire-filled nets, various different ideas that people have had, and looking at how they can protect their offshore assets.
Excellent. And listeners should note that we'll also be having an interview with a colleague of David's who will be talking quite specifically on those aspects of the research, which I'm sure those of you involved in installation of monopiles and offshore structures will find very, very interesting indeed. For youngsters coming through into the system, you know, young men and women at university wanting to pursue a career, what would you say to them in terms of, you know, any interests in physical versus digital modelling? Is there enough of an opening for this to be a valid career pathway for somebody, or is it sort of too niche?
I mean, we're not expecting it to go anywhere anytime soon. I would say that really what companies are looking for are people that are rounded. So people that have an understanding of all of the different aspects. So you'll need a good amount of analytical skills. If you can have experience of programming, whether that's with MATLAB or Python, that stands you in good stead, whether you end up in a numerical or a physical modeling type role. And if you can have experience of numerical modeling as well as physical modeling, then it just makes you a really well-rounded researcher that understands the levels of data that go into both and the levels of outputs and processing that are required from both. I suppose my advice to people that are doing their degrees or are looking to at the moment is that the experiences that you have outside of your degree can be just as important as what you have within your degree. So if you finish your degree, you will be competing with everybody that's just finished your degree as well. So what can you do? What can you find? What summer jobs can you do? What additional pieces of research can you do working with your lecturers, with PhD students that you know? How can you help out there? What can you do that will set you apart in an interview from all of the people around you who really are your friends at the moment, but will become your competitors when you finish?
Yes, no, that's very sound advice. And it's certainly one of the reasons I encourage young people to consider joining, whether it be SUT or IMRS or whichever of the professional societies and learning societies are relevant to what you're studying. Because it does give you that little bit of edge later on when you're competing for the available jobs. And I should congratulate David, who's just recently achieved his Chartered Marine Scientist through the IMRS scheme as well. And certainly we'll be encouraging SUT members to pursue the Chartered Marine Technologist that we offer in conjunction with IMRS and MTS as well. So Dave, how accurate are the models that you make compared with the real world?
I suppose that everything that we do is about accuracy, really. So although we're working at scale, what that actually means is that any small areas get magnified once you move up to full scale, right? They could be 20 times, they could be 50 times the size of the errors, if there are any at small scale.
Sure. Okay, yes, because of course errors are scaled too, yes.
Exactly, yeah. So that puts quite a bit of pressure on the work that we do. And with things like, say, breakwater armor units, at full scale, they're going to be several tons, and they're going to be placed individually using a crane. So when we build them in the models, we can't just scatter them about. Each unit has to be hand-placed according to exactly the same specifications that they use when they're placing them at full scale. That takes time, and it actually takes quite a significant amount of training before people are allowed to place army units on models. And some of the models that we run will have thousands or even tens of thousands of army units on them, which need to be placed accurately and checked off to make sure that they have been placed correctly. Most of the things that we do, we're working on a plus minus 2 millimeter tolerance. So if you stood on any one of our models at a sort of 1 to 50 scale, you're within about 10 centimeters of where you would be at full scale. So it never really ceases to amaze me how accurate the guys are that we have, the technicians and the carpenters that make these things, that we're able to say that with confidence to people, that what you're looking at is a real representation of what it really looks like out in the real world.
That's really impressive, isn't it? Dave, when I visited the facility, one of the things as a one-time mariner that always catches my eye is the quite large and detailed models of ship hulls that are in use around the facility as well. So can you tell me a little bit about what the ship models are used for?
Yeah, so when we're looking at ports or harbours and we're doing tests on expansions or on new developments, one of the things that we have to look at is how the ships will behave within those areas. So we may be measuring the waves and the amount of wave energy that gets in, but that doesn't always tell you everything that you need to know about the ship response. So we have accurate ship models that are made for us that represent real ships. So it may be Triple E or something, and we'll weight them accurately so they'll be ballasted correctly, whether they're unladen, part laden, fully laden. And we'll connect them up to mooring lines, but mooring lines that are measured, monitored using strain gauges. So you measure the forces under the test conditions. So as the wave energy comes into the harbor, you can measure the tension within the mooring lines to work out whether, if that was a real storm with a real ship in a real harbor, would it have broken away from its mooring lines? How safe is it in that environment? And as you can imagine, if you have quite a full harbour or quite a full port area filled with ships, then the interaction between those vessels becomes very important as well. You know, so if you have one that's undergoing motion, that can generate waves that will influence another. You know, you can get feedback mechanisms set up between the different ships that are in the port area. And so it's really important not only to see how much wave energy is going to enter into that area, but to see how it will interact with the structures that are most likely to be in that area, looking at the feedback mechanisms and making sure that you're designing with those in mind as well.
Okay. And how are you capturing the data? Has this been done with almost sort of full-time video coverage, or are there effectively seabed-based systems as well? How, you know, what are you actually using to measure, whether it be ship movement or sediment movement?
Yeah, so strain gauges on the mooring lines to measure the tension. We have a full 6 degree of freedom Qualysys system, so we can measure the actual motion of the ships in a full three-dimensional space for analysis afterwards. Wave heights and periods are measured with wave probes. So they're resistance probes that measure the elevation of the water as it moves up and down the probes. We use a lot of Nortec equipment, actually. So Nortec Aquadops, Vectrinos, and AECPs for measuring the current speeds and for measuring, you can do waves with them as well now. And we develop our own in-house technology as well. So for some of the sediment transport studies that we've done, we've developed a system of scour probes. So like a wave probe, which measures between the air and water interface as the water moves up and down, a new system which measures between the water and sediment interface. So you can get a continual record of exactly what level the sediment is at during a period of erosion. We use underwater laser scanners as well. So if we're doing mobile sediment tests and we're looking at how sediment is moving around, we have underwater laser scanners that will map the bathymetry. It's effectively like a sonar system. We use lasers, but it basically does exactly the same thing as a sonar system out in the real world, that it's a line laser that you move up and down over the bed and you build a 3D picture of the bathymetry. And for breakwaters, we would use a normal in-air laser scanner, so an infrared laser scanner, so that we can measure the movement of any of the armor units. And one thing, the structures often look particularly colorful when you come to look at them, but it has a really, I mean, it looks great, but it also has a really practical purpose, that the various different forms of material that are making up that structure are sprayed different colors. So the tow material, you know, the armor material, the different sizes of armor material will be different colors. And the reason for that is that if you get pieces of rock or armor units or other things that are displaced between layers, then the color change will enable you to see that you've had migration there. But also, they're only ever sprayed on the top. And that may just seem like laziness, but actually, again, it serves a purpose, that you often get material that turns over or moves slightly in a layer that doesn't actually displace to another layer. So you know when you go back at the end of the experiment, when you're looking at it or when you're reviewing photos or videos, that you are able immediately to see visually that something has moved or something has turned over or something has changed because of that change in color. We'll use image techniques. So we'll take photos from fixed positions and use image extraction techniques where you look at the difference between the two. And we can do the same with video. So we may video an entire test, take the first frame, take the last frame, subtract the two, and you're then able to see what a difference there has been over the course of the test.
And the fact that your clients come back for more strongly suggests that the technique and the technology works. Do you have some good examples of, you know, real life incidents which you were able to either predict or accurately reproduce after the event?
Yeah, so we worked on the first marine current turbine installation in the UK, which was the MayGen project, which was installed off the Pentland Firth.
Mm-hmm.
And there we were looking at the numerical modelling results that had been done for the on-bottom stability. So these are turbines that have been put out in 4.5 meter a second flows. So ballasting those structures to hold them onto the seabed was quite a significant task. And what we were able to show with the physical modelling was that the sheltering effect based on the bed roughness that they have in the area would cause a retardation of the flow profile and therefore allow them to reduce the amount of weight that was required to stabilize the turbines on the bed, which obviously the more weight you have to put on, the more money it costs. So by reducing the weight, we were able to save them a little bit of money. And that was an incredibly exciting project to work on because it really was a UK first, if not a world first, to be putting out those commercial turbines in that way.
Dave, thanks very much. So if people want to find out more about HR Wallingford or get in touch, where should they go?
Sure. So there's the website, which is www.hrwallingford.com. So that's hotelromeowallingford.com. Or you can email info@hrwallingford.com to ask anything that you want to know or to get in touch with me.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. To find out more about SUT, you can go to sut.org. If you'd like to get in touch or find out how you can be featured on a future podcast, or would like to find out how to sponsor an upcoming podcast, email info@sut.org. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review, and we'll be back with a new episode next week.